This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor for the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you tuning in today on Trumpet Hour, and our panel of trumpet writers have a lot of really significant stories that they're eager to tell you all about. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And also still temporarily with us in Edmond is Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And also visiting with us here in Edmond today, we have Sam Livingston.
Glad to be here.
And also joining us via Skype from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Well, in recent months, we've discussed several stories that just show that the NATO alliance that has played such a vital role in stabilizing the world for so many years is on thin ice. U.S. President Donald Trump has been pursuing an America-first foreign policy, which has made the other NATO nations wonder just how much they can rely on America's security backing. And then at one point, Mr. Trump really shocked the other NATO nations when he said that he may not honor Article 5. Of the NATO treaty, which is really the backbone of the organization. And now this week, there's another story that has not received quite as much press as those other developments, but that could represent another major blow to the Atlantic Alliance. To tell us about this, we'll go to our man in Europe, Richard Palmer.
Yes, in a lot of ways, this is the other side of the coin that doesn't get as explored so much of what's going on with NATO. And that is that Germany really is pursuing a Germany-first policy. And in this case, they've been very determinedly working on an very important pipeline with Russia. It's a pipeline that goes under the North Sea. They've got one already called Nord Stream. They're building a second one that's called Nord Stream 2. And the idea behind these pipelines are, I mean, they basically represent a massive increase in Russian power because they allow Russia to cut off any Eastern European nation they want from Russian gas supplies while at the same time still supplying Western Europe and all of their customers in Western Europe with natural gas pumped via Germany. So before they could cut nations off, but it meant cutting off a bunch of Western Europe as well, losing a bunch of revenue, making Western Europe mad with them. Now it transforms Russia's energy weapon into a much more precise tool and makes it much more usable. And a lot of nations are very annoyed about this, especially Poland. Poland has apparently starting to call this pipeline the Molotov-Ribbentrop II pipeline after that infamous pact in World War II where Germany and Russia divided up Poland and the rest of Eastern Europe between them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Germany's been doing this for quite a while, and they very publicly promote sanctions and encourage Europe to stay united on sanctions against Russia, while all the while in the background keeping the work on this pipeline going, twisting the European Union's arm to make sure they don't derail the pipeline, making sure the sanctions are very carefully worded so they don't affect it. And then last week, or just towards the end of last week, America got involved. The U.S. Senate passed a bill 98-2. Mm-hmm. That would put in new rounds of sanctions on Russia, and it was specifically targeting Russia's energy infrastructure. The big aim of this sanctions would be to prevent Western companies developing Russian oil fields, especially oil fields where they need Western technology, you know, shale gas, Arctic oil fields, this kind of thing. But it also gives the American government the ability to put sanctions on any European countries working or companies working on Nord Stream. So working with Gazprom to build these pipelines with Germany. So it's a piece of legislation that could see America basically telling all of these massive German energy giants, you stop working with Gazprom. Germany, you stop this pipeline right now, or we're mobilizing the full force of the dollar-denominated economy against you. And it's something America did against Iran and any companies that worked with Iran. It's been very effective. It basically just tries to shut them out of these companies out of the entire economic system. So if this eventually goes ahead, and it seemed very positive in the Senate, then it puts Germany in a very interesting. It basically makes Germany choose. And so far, it's tried to play both sides, you know, staying close-ish to the United States, maintaining this backdoor with Russia. This would throw down the, you know, who do you want to be friends with, us or Russia? Choose now.
So, and what would you expect Germany's response to be? Do you think that these German energy companies will continue to do the business there with Russia despite the threat of U.S. sanctions, or do you expect Germany to sort of cave into U.S. pressure?
Well, the first thing they'll do is do everything that they can to stop that decision point coming. Mm-hmm. So it's gone through the Senate. It's not gone through Congress, and Congress are they're fine with it, I believe, in principle, but there's some constitutional issues. They think they should have originated the bill. So they'll try and play up everything. And then there is the U.S. administration does have some discretion in terms of how these sanctions are applied. So, again, they'll really work the U.S. They'll work on the president and try and do everything they can to stop him doing that. And you saw on Friday, actually, you know, German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel and the Austrian Foreign Minister kind of came out screaming blue murder, threatening sanctions on the United States if they went ahead with this. So they'll try and do everything they can to stop being forced to make that decision. If they do, I mean, on the one hand, it does seem like it would be much more logical to say, well, we're not going to go against the United States. We'll lose this pipeline. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem worth it. But given the climate of relations between America and Germany right now, given just how quickly we've seen things deteriorate, given how much emphasis Germany's placed on this pipeline in the past, you know, I wouldn't place any money on them backing down on it. And if they don't back down, I think that is where things get really interesting, because at that point, Germany's got no option really but to try and just go all out economic war on the entire dollar-denominated system of doing the economy if they want to try and help their energy companies survive these sanctions and get through them. So it is something that does represent not necessarily a probable, but certainly a very real possibility of all-out economic war between Europe and between Germany and America. And even I just saw a news story today from CNBC where they did a survey of German CFOs, chief financial officers, where about basically two-thirds of them said that they were expecting some form of economic war between Germany and America shortly. So it's a situation that's potentially very volatile and could build very dramatically if America continues to push forward with this.
Well, it's easy to see how Russia benefits from these ties with Germany. But what does Germany have to gain from this pipeline relationship with Russia, especially since, as you mentioned, economic war with the U.S. is at risk?
Yeah, you're right. It is interesting because it does. I mean, they've clung to this much harder than I would have expected, you know, just throughout the mouse, or you would expect looking at it on the surface for the last 7-8 years. So it is obviously very important to them. Partly, I think, is money. Mm-hmm. You know, they can get cheaper gas from Russia this way. Since they've shut down their nuclear power plants, they are very reliant on gas, and so it, you know, it's a big boost to their economy. I think the other thing that Trumpet columnist Robert Morley has brought out is that it gives Germany the same kind of energy weapon for companies downstream of Germany that Russia has, because it now means that just about all of Western Europe relies on Russian gas via Germany. And so then it gives Germany the ability to kind of almost as a client of Russia, turn off power, you know, on and off. But perhaps also it's just a case of hedging their bets.
Right.
Germany, they've always had this kind of option of turning east. And you saw this during the Cold War with talk of Ostpolitik, as they called it. And there was always a strong segment, even within West Germany, that said, well, we should try and steer a middle path between the U.S. and Russia, that we should, or some even saying, well, we should go all the way over to Russia. I think they don't want to be to the point where they have no options other than the United States. And so by keeping this relationship open with Russia, it keeps an alternative relationship alive. And in the era of Donald Trump, where they're talking more, or German politicians are talking more and more about America being unreliable, well, an alternative ally, an alternative relationship is more important than ever.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, we've just crossed the five-month mark in the presidency of Donald Trump here in the United States. And one huge difference that we've seen so far between his administration and the previous Obama administration is in its policy toward Iran. And one really telling way to examine just how deep those differences are is by looking at it through the lens of the Arabian Peninsula nation of Oman. To explain this sort of triangular diplomacy between the U.S., Iran, and Oman, we'll go to our Middle East analyst, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, what we've seen, as you've said, over the past 5 months is just a multifaceted strategy by the United States to limit Iran's influence across the Middle East. And they are doing this in many ways. They're doing this in Syria, even by really strengthening their ties with Saudi Arabia. And also this week, it came out that they're also attempting this strategy to kind of hedge about Iran and slow their march in Oman. Oman, the tiny country that doesn't get much press just because of its low economic standing in the world, small population. It is an important nation, though, strategically, because, as you said, it is does form the south eastern tip of the Saudi Peninsula. And it's very important. This is a strategic area because the Straits of Hormuz there, which a lot of the world's oil and gas supply comes out of or comes through, it's only 20 plus miles, quite narrow. And on one side of that, you have Iran, which obviously seeks to dominate this area, especially the Persian Gulf. It's called the Persian Gulf after Persia or ancient Iran. The Saudis call it the Arabian Gulf. But on the other side of Iran there, across the Straits of Hormuz, you have Oman, and that is a deeper channel that is closer to the Omani side. So actually all traffic that comes through the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz travels through Omani territory. And what we've seen over time, especially the last decade, is Iran really try and become closer to Oman and invest heavily in Oman to really strengthen the economic ties between those nations, to the point that Oman will be beholden to Iran's will. And we saw this really ratchet up when Oman started to be used by Iran in its support of the Houthis next door in Yemen. Yemen's on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula, below Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea side. Mm-hmm. And obviously since 2014, as we've talked about, they have been mobilized. They're a Shiite group that's been supported by Iran. And Iran has sent shipments of arms to them to try and fight against the Yemeni government. And that was effective, but it started to get shut down by a U.S. coalition that caught a bunch of these ships. I think five shipments in total they've caught heading to the Houthis in northern Yemen. So Oman was tapped by Iran then to be used in to resupply the Houthis by the overland route. So instead of having to jump on it, get on a ship, all these arms and sail to ports in the middle part of the Red Sea, all they needed to do is jump now this 20-mile gap of the Straits of Hormuz, dock in Omani territory, and then be convoyed across Oman to Yemen. And this is what we saw back in September last year. And this was done under the noses of the Obama administration as well. There was the general saw it and they were upset by it, but not much action was taken. Well, what we saw last week, or 2 weeks ago, and just was broke this week, is that there was a couple of American diplomats belonging to the Trump administration that headed in to have secret talks with the leadership of Oman and said, "We would really, really like you to stop that. Do not allow your territory any longer to be used for the transfer of Iranian weapons to the Houthis."
Hmm. So what's your view on this? Do you think that Iran's overtures to Oman will be successful in sort of pulling them permanently, or at least in the medium term, into the Iranian camp?
Well, it really depends on what the U.S. can offer them, because Oman is in a very tight position right here. Iran is their chief, and Iran has worked it out this way. They're their chief economic partner, and most trade deals come between those two states. And the United States knows they can't cut off Oman from that. And that's what we wrote, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, that We wrote an article about this and how it looked like, because of Iran's strategy, as we talked about, to govern this sea lane all the way around from the Strait of Hormuz to the Red Sea, that they're going to increasingly put pressure on Oman to side with them. And they did this economically. And we got a lot of flack actually writing this story from Omanis saying that'll never happen. We're not in a league with anyone. We try to maintain a centrist power. We're not Sunni. We're not Shiite. We can maintain the balance here between the Saudis and the Iranians. But we wrote that, no, you will become beholden to Iran. You have no choice because of their economic strength there and investment. And so it really depends on how much the United States is willing to give up. But just importantly, what this shows is Iran's strategy through to use Oman to garner strength through this sea lane, which is something that was forecast by our editor-in-chief back in 2011, before anyone was focused on Iran's movements through around the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea. He came out and said, Iran's going to dominate this area. And that's when we've seen the relationship between Oman and Iran strengthen.
And it looks like they're really having quite a lot of success with that strategy. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. In recent centuries, so many of the great global powers like the UK, France, Russia, and the United States have involved themselves deeply in the Middle East. These powers have all engaged with Middle Eastern nations to varying degrees, and each one has become friends with a few of those Middle Eastern countries, but usually enemies with far more of them. But China, though, historically has played only a very minimal role in the Middle East. China was a latecomer to the international system. And then for many years, even after China was a global player, its policy of non-interference kept on minimizing its diplomatic and security engagement there in the Middle East. But now, somewhat suddenly, we see that changing. China is beginning to engage with all kinds of Middle Eastern nations. And this week, the latest evidence of that emerged when China and Iran conducted some joint military drills. To tell us about this story, we'll go to Sam Livingston.
Thank you, Jeremiah. And as you said earlier this week, I think it was on Sunday, China and Iran conducted joint naval drills. They were in the Strait of Hormuz. The drills had been planned for a while, so it wasn't that controversial, but the timing and just the optics of this, as you said, going on at this time in that area, and of course between these two countries, I think the big takeaway here is that what China is doing is directly undermining the United States in the Middle East. Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism. They're just constantly at odds with the United States, taking provocative actions against the American Navy in the Strait of Hormuz. You remember a few years ago, or just even last year, when they took over that U.S. ship and took those 10 sailors hostage. So by no means are America and Iran friends here. So then to see China come over and carry out these drills with our enemy, or with America's enemy, is directly undermining what the United States is trying to do here. And then you hear China's response to these drills. This is from a former Chinese military general. He says, instead of taking sides over the controversy between Qatar and its neighboring countries in the Middle East recently, China's standpoint has always been neutral and conciliatory on the issue. So they play this card that they're a neutral party, that they're just going in there to, I guess they don't want to take sides, obviously. But really what's at heart here is that China, they primarily, first and foremost, as any nation would, they have their own interests in mind. Primarily, they want to protect trade, and they want to undermine the United States. So China isn't concerned about who's right or wrong. They're concerned about, we want to protect the Strait of Hormuz. It's a crucial, crucial trade route there with that Persian Gulf oil. And then this is part of their broader, agenda to expand their global presence. Their only military base outside of China is in Djibouti, right on the Bab el-Mandeb. So they're protecting their interests going through Red Sea trade. Now they're getting involved in the Strait of Hormuz. So obviously these drills are significant in that they undermine the United States, but that it does show China's aggression and their forwardness in protecting their interests well beyond their coastlines.
How does China's One Belt, One Road initiative factor into these drills here?
Well, like you said in the opening there, they are very interested in protecting those trade routes around. You can see all around the southern coast of, or the southern coast of Asia, around the Indian Ocean. They have pacts with Sri Lanka, with Pakistan, with Thailand. They carry out drills with them. And those are all major ports that they have to protect them going up into the Red Sea. And then again, crucial trade with Europe passes all along through there. China is just vitally interested in making sure that they have a foothold over those ports and that they're in control of them.
So China's suddenly awake, and it's very much an active international player. Could you put that in the context of Bible prophecy?
I think with this, you see them more, as they're taking over more of these vital sea lanes, these sea gates, this is going to come into, it will be very important when you think about the alliance that we've talked about between Europe and Asia. We know that Europe is going to intervene in the Middle East. There is going to be a conflict there between Iran and the King of the North, and there's no getting around it. If Europe wants to intervene in the Middle East, China is going to be watching very closely, and there is going to be that brief relationship there. So China is definitely investing more in this region, and it'll be interesting to see how that impacts those relations with Europe.
Well, thanks very much for that, Sam. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there very soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story that shows the deep and very disturbing links between Nazi Germany and Latin America. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Earlier this week, Latin American authorities in Argentina revealed a story that police have recently discovered the largest trove of Nazi artifacts so far in that country. Mm-hmm. This was by a private collector whose identity has not been revealed, but well hidden. It was behind a bookshelf and then behind a door and then down a staircase, where they had up to like 75 different artifacts, including like bust of Adolf Hitler, tools for measuring mortars, a key with the Krupp Steel Company emblem, mm-hmm, on the box, and several other things that the authorities believe were brought to Argentina in the immediate aftermath of World War II by refugees, I guess, quote unquote, refugees, some of them being even war criminals fleeing Nazi Germany.
Yeah, on the Trumpet, we've written before about what's called the rat lines. Could you just talk a little bit about what those were and how that factors in? I mean, that was really the path, I guess, that these refugees took to get into Latin America there. Is that right?
Right. Well, there were definitely several key figures in Hitler's regime, including Colonel Otto Scorenzi, who had close ties with the Juan Perón's dictatorship in Latin America, even being hired on after the war as the bodyguard for his wife. And then Perón brought in several other high-ranking Nazi officials, including Colonel Rudel, like a flying ace, to advise his regime on military tactics. And I believe you had actually written something, like 6 years ago, Colonel Scorenzi's, who had written a letter to some key figures in the Vatican, mm-hmm, to start bringing more of these war criminals from Germany into Argentina. And actually, interesting, I have a newspaper clipping in my office from the mid-50s, 1950s, where it has the photo of Colonel Scorenzi, who was one of Hitler's chief SS commandos, mm-hmm, standing next to dictator Juan Perón, and the business representative from Krupp Steel, just providing more weight for the idea that a lot of the business contacts that Germany, even today, has in Latin America were started in the late 40s and 50s by German companies who knew key figures from Hitler's regime who went to Argentina and then were able to kind of give them the inside track on getting some of that industry built up down there. You said Colonel Scorenzi was very influential in coordinating between German industry, the Vatican, and Juan Perón's dictatorship in Argentina. And even though this recent treasure trove, this artifact, this trove, hasn't had any links to Scorenzi in particular, as I mentioned, it does actually have some of those memorabilia are in boxes or in cases with the Krupp Steel logo on them, just really kind of highlighting the close ties that German industrialists had with both the Nazi regime and Argentina after the war.
And of course, Krupp Steel became Tyson Krupp, which is a company very valuable today. And pretty much any time you get inside an elevator, you'll probably, you know, be in a Tyson Krupp product there. Is there proof about the Catholic Church's involvement in smuggling, you know, Nazi war criminals out of Germany and into Latin America?
Definitely. Well, like I mentioned before, we've published on our website. It's been a couple of years now. We've published on our website the letter from or the Colonel Scorenzi to some of the chief bishops in the Catholic Church, and that's always the tricky thing with those is that, I mean, oftentimes you will, there's definitely proof of particular bishops helping, and a lot of times the Vatican will try to pawn this off as them acting on their own, although I think it was Pope Paul VI was one of those bishops. So it definitely goes very high up.
Could you talk briefly about the prophetic significance of just this ever-deepening evidence of links between Nazi-era Germany and the Catholic nations of Latin America?
Right. Well, it really gets back to a prophecy in Revelation where it talks about the beast that was and is and then was, and it went into the bottomless pit and then emerged back out of it. The language is kind of cryptic, but as thetrumpet.com and our predecessor, The Plain Truth, under Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong always pointed out, is that this is just really showing that this Third Reich, this beast, this prophetic beast, it didn't die. It just went underground, and then it will emerge again. And so that's really kind of what we're seeing here, is that some of these key officials in the Third Reich, in Hitler's regime, that they went underground and really laid the foundation for the modern European Union and for the business connections between Germany and Latin America. And even though all those people are either dead or really, really, really old by now, the foundation for a German empire that they set is still very relevant in politics today, and that is prophesied.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. And the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about Germany spying on America, what it would take for Qatar to have the embargo that's on it lifted, a tremendously powerful Russian cyber weapon, and we'll also talk about the ongoing shift in American beliefs about the origins of life. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Listeners may remember a huge story that broke a few years back about the United States spying on Germany. This news was a diplomatic earthquake. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that German-U.S. relations were severely shaken by the revelation. She famously said, quote, "Spying among friends, that isn't done." And then Germany ended up summoning the U.S. envoy to talk about this miscarriage of diplomacy, and the German public was furious. Polls showed that their approval of America plummeted after this news came out. Well, this week, another story broke showing that all along, Germany had also been spying on America and even targeting the White House. To talk about this story, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, it's something that's now pretty embarrassing for the German government. This was a huge deal. If you remember, just a few years ago, between Germany and America, and there were big speeches about it. The left-wing SDP, especially, just really jumped on board and criticizing, condemning America. I think at the time I even wrote something like, we can be pretty sure that Germany's doing the same thing and that the big crime that America made here is getting caught spying on Germany rather than actually spying on Germany. And now we've got the proof of that. Yesterday, Spiegel published an article citing documents that I guess had been passed to them in some fashion that showed that the BND, as they put it, had considerable interest in the United States as a target of espionage. Their documents showed just under 4,000 search terms or selectors that they used for targeting what to spy on. So they spied. These included telephone, fax, and email accounts belonging to things like Lockheed Martin and defense companies, NASA, Human Rights Watch, universities, military facilities, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Defense Intelligence Agency, secret service agencies from various American armed forces, the White House, foreign embassies, the International Monetary Fund, the Arab League, not in America, but bizarrely enough, also the British Library somehow received a lot of attention from the BND. And nobody's really got any idea why on earth they were so interested in a collection of a load of old books. But you see just this deep, actually pretty deep spying on allies.
So how far up the line in the German leadership does this go? Does this suggest that Merkel herself lied and has some culpability?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Obviously, this is still kind of a breaking story. Spiegel were the ones that leaked the document, and that article was only published yesterday evening. So in terms of hounding down exactly how far this goes, that hasn't been done yet. But on the one hand, the German intelligence agency, the BND, they have quite a long history of going rogue, or at least being accused of going rogue. Mm. For example, they during the 90s, they were caught smuggling weapons to the Croatian Air Force and Croats during the Yugoslav War, facilitating pilot training, this kind of thing. And that caused a huge uproar in Germany at the time that they were caught doing these things. And I think the government excuse kind of was, the BND, they were acting without our knowledge. This was just them. They were acting on their own. And since then, that's come up a few other times as well, where they've been caught sending weapons to people that really shouldn't have been sending weapons to, and this kind of thing. And again, there's been this arm's length, this arm's length relationship there. Now, how much of that is just convenient, plausible deniability? Mm-hmm. We really don't know. I mean, on the one hand, you have the German intelligence agency repeatedly going rogue, and if that's true, well, that's very worrying because, this is firstly, it's an intelligence agency. That's a huge amount of power. Secondly, this specific intelligence agency, about 5 years ago, there was a whole bunch of documents came out about how thoroughly involved ex-Nazis were in setting up this agency and just running that agency for the first few decades of its history. So you either have an intelligence agency set up by former Nazis that is repeatedly going rogue, or perhaps worse, you have it goes all the way to the top and the German government are doing these things, spying on America, illegal arms trades, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Either way, it should be a hugely concerning situation. I think, though, I mean, maybe it's because it's early days, but this, I would have thought American newspapers would have jumped on this, or American news, what? You guys were having it lecturing us so much for so long, and you were doing exactly the same thing. I would have thought that would be a front page headline, but I don't think I've really seen anything in the American press. I'm sure they have covered it in some way, but it hasn't received the attention I would have thought it would have.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we'll have to keep our eye on that and see if an uproar is made over this or if it just sort of blows over. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, on a recent episode of Trumpet Hour, we talked about Qatar coming under all kinds of pressure from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf nations. And as part of this pressure, these nations even imposed a pretty serious trade and diplomatic embargo on Qatar. Just today, Saudi Arabia has released a list of demands. This is a wide-ranging list, and it could add more tensions to an already volatile situation there on the Gulf. And to bring us up to speed on this story, we'll go once again to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it's easy to think of this as just being a not very important event geopolitically, but Qatar has essentially been cut off in every single possible way from its main neighbors, geographic neighbors. And for the past 2 weeks, it's been trying to get in food from Iran, from Turkey, from other places to try and just sustain its nation. And finally, what we saw this week, or even I think it was yesterday, is today, the demands actually set by Saudi Arabia and the other Middle Eastern states that want to really move Qatar away from its relationship, mainly with Iran. The United States pressured them, the Saudi Arabia, to finally work up a list and say, hey, you better comply with these clauses. If you do, we'll regain full relations with you. And just some of these are important because it shows you what Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf nations and Egypt are actually concerned about. Number one is curb diplomatic ties with Iran. They have to expel the IRGC, Revolutionary Guard Corps, members from Qatar. They have to close its diplomatic missions inside Iran. They want them to do that. Then they also want them to sever all their ties to terrorist organizations such as the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic State, Hezbollah. And then they also want them, number three, to shut down Al Jazeera, which is a pretty pretty big ask.
Yes.
Al Jazeera is the mouthpiece for Qatar across the Middle East. It has huge power at shaping Middle Eastern public opinion.
Right.
And the Saudis are sick of it, and they don't want to give the Qataris too much control over feeding other Middle Eastern states and the peoples information that is detrimental to Saudi Arabia's cause.
Is that because Al Jazeera is perceived as too pro-Iranian?
It's Qatari, so it does. Qatar's always kind of been in the middle between Oman and Saudi Arabia. But historically, we've seen Al Jazeera really promote interest outside of what Saudi Arabia would want. Just going back to 2011, this is probably the first time that Al Jazeera went mainstream, that we all were watching Al Jazeera when we were looking at Tahrir Square in the middle of the Islamic Spring, the Arab Spring across the Middle East in Cairo, and we were watching the people march and try and call for Mubarak's demise. That was all an Al Jazeera feed that we were watching. I remember at the time thinking, is this even right? Why am I watching Al Jazeera? But since that time, and the support that it gave to those, and the voice it gave to those protesters, Al Jazeera has continued that type of narrative, which is not necessarily pro-Iran, but it's definitely not pro-Saudi Arabian. And even following when Mubarak was removed, what did Qatar do? But they basically gave the Muslim Brotherhood billions of dollars inside Egypt to cement its rule. And so we've seen this long-standing support of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, of the Islamist groups inside Libya as well. So they have been working for their own cause, it seems, but it seems to be aligning more with Iran and the Saudis right now. They're sick of it.
Is Saudi Arabia taking these demands on Qatar too far, or do you think that these are justified?
I think they're justified. I don't think that you would, and a lot of people are saying that, not just even many Americans, even left-wing Americans, because of the way that Qatar does fund terrorism across the Middle East. So I don't think they're taking them too far. The question is mainly, will it be effective? Is Qatar already too far gone to be swayed by these demands, which are extremely stringent? Will they cut off their relationship with Iran in favor of Saudi Arabia? And I don't know if they will. Mm-hmm. We tend to think of everyone in the Saudi Peninsula forming part of this alliance that was going to be is anti-Iranian. And
right.
The broad majority of that, I definitely think, is true. But this nation, it seems, is kind of like the bridge from Iran to other Middle Eastern nations, Sunni states, that we know are eventually going to ally with Iran. If we just look at their involvement historically in Libya, which we know is going to fall to Iran, in Egypt, which we know is going to fall to Iran, and even some more Red Sea states, Yemen, Qatar always goes on the pro-Iranian side of that. So I wonder whether the Saudis will be effective. I think, based on Bible prophecy, they might not be. And they might be not be able to rip Iran or Qatar out of Iran's hands. And I think that might actually promote the fulfillment of these of Iranian takeover in these Sunni states, which it's been hard to see how they would do that, honestly. Right. But Qatar may form that bridge.
Wow. Well, thank you, Brent. All of the stories that we're discussing today, or almost all of them anyway, are published on thetrumpet.com. Please visit there to check these stories out and also to subscribe to our free print edition and our free email news briefs. Cyber terrorism is a threat that seems to be more ominous each month as we increasingly depend economically, militarily, and in so many other areas on cyber technologies. And Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadidwe has written an article this week about new Russian cyber weaponry that might be capable of disrupting any power grid on the planet. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Sam Livingston.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Last year, there was a cyber attack that shut down one-fifth of Kiev's power grid. It was the first successful attack on an electrical grid in a city of that scale. So again, one-fifth of the Ukrainian capital. Earlier this week, a research group named Dragos published a report highlighting the dangers of this particular malware that was used in this attack. They call it Crash Override, and they believe that Russia is behind this, that it's related or similar to other attacks that Russia has carried out. Russia, as you'd expect, is silent about it, hasn't said anything. Earlier this month, though, Vladimir Putin coyly alluded to the Russian government not being able to control people who he says have certain patriotic leanings. And I think that in itself is what is more frightening about this, that this is a weapon essentially that no longer needs the funding and the resources of a state government to be carried out, that it's something that it can just be some rogue official or just even a graduate, it's just someone with a science degree in or in computer science could carry out an attack like this. In their report, they said this malware can be immediately repurposed to attack Europe and portions of the Middle East and Asia. It's extensible, and with a small amount of tailoring, it would also be effective in the North America power grid. And now power grids are incredibly vulnerable. They're huge machines. They stretch, span the entire country. There's all sorts of ways to get into them. So this is a very vulnerable thing for a country. It's frightening because we are so reliant on it. And now there are things where just some guy in his basement could probably come up with something where he could really cripple an entire city. Now, it is a bit speculative that Russia is directly behind it, but like what Putin said, they're not trying to stop it. They're encouraging that, and they're not going to admit, of course, that they are part of it. Some security officials say that they strongly believe that Russia is behind it. And again, it does demonstrate how vulnerable we are in America and Western Europe, that we're not at all impervious to these sorts of attacks. Especially if you're Eastern Europe, those countries would be would be shaking right now to see what Russia did in Kiev, that they're capable of doing something like that, using that as a weapon.
And as they say, never believe anything until the Kremlin denies it. So what would you say in practical terms an attack like this would look like, for example, on if one of America's major cities were to have its power grid targeted?
I believe it did happen earlier this year. I don't know that that was a hack, but I think San Francisco and New York, certain parts of the city went without power. They said that this particular malware, it can be taken care of relatively quickly, that it just shuts the power down for maybe 4 to 5 hours until someone can manually get to these power stations to take care of it. But the fact that it is so simple that you don't need a state government to carry it out, this could just become more and more crippling as more and more people start to figure out how to do it. You could just see cities blacking out across the United States and no one knows what to do about it. So we are for sure behind in how to prevent these sorts of attacks.
Well, thanks very much for that, Sam. Here in the United States, as in many parts of the world, there's been a dispute raging for the last century about whether mankind was created by God or whether people evolved from less advanced life forms. And the latest poll on these beliefs in America show that for the very first time, the belief in God's direct creation of man was not the most common response. To tell us about this development, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we do have an article up on our website about this now, which actually I've gotten a bit of response back with a lot of people just really shocked because that's not the stereotype or the impression of America. The impression is like America is the most religious nation in the Western world.
Right.
And even though only about 10% of the population would publicly deny the existence of God, this poll does show that up to 57% of Americans do believe that mankind evolved from some lower life form or some animal life form over the last several million years. The percent that believe that God created man in his own image at some point in the past 10,000 years was only 38%, which is the lowest since Gallup started keeping track in 1985, and it's a safe assumption that probably be the lowest ever. Now, it is interesting when you break down that 57% who believe that mankind evolved, it's not all like your classic version of evolution that you'd have learned in college. 38% of Americans believe that God directed human evolution from animals over the course of the last several million years. So
basically that God is the creator, but then he uses some form of evolution to sort of accomplish parts of his creation.
Right. You call that like theistic evolution is the label they usually put on that, which would be equal to the direct creation belief as far as how many people believe it. It's 38% believe that God formed man in his own image. Another 38% who believe that God created evolution and guided humans' development from animals. And then only about 19-20% who believe the more typical secular evolutionist belief that God had nothing to do with man's creation whatsoever.
So what does this shift in your view tell us about society in general? What does it mean that fewer people believe in God's involvement?
Well, I mean, definitely the reason the shift is happening is because of the education system. I mean, since the 50s, I mean, it's been legally permitted to teach evolution in schools, even to the point of discriminating against creationist teachers. So the younger generation is definitely learning this, and a lot of people compromised with it to the point where they combined what they learn at church and what they learn at school into this new theistic evolution belief that's becoming so prevalent. But even that, when you look at the millennial generation, it's 51% believe that God had no role in man's creation whatsoever.
Wow.
So you could see for the next two or three decades, theistic evolution's going to win out over the belief in direct creation. But within a generation or so, you'd be like a majority of secular agnostics in a more way, more like many European nations are.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last brief look at some of the other big headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll start with Richard.
Mackerel is the new flavor of the month. That's a merging of the names of Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel. Macron won big his party won big in the French parliamentary elections that concluded on Monday. He has a huge mandate now, and he plans to transform France's economy and then work much more closely for Germany. So we can watch that partnership now and see how that changes the European Union.
And Andrew?
Well, as political violence increases in America, a shocking total of 30 Republican congressmen have either been attacked or received a death threat since the beginning of May. This string of attacks began on May 8th when someone tried to run Representative David Krustoff of Tennessee off the road with their car. The most high-profile attack was obviously the shooting of Representative Steve Scalise from Louisiana. But the most recent one occurred only yesterday when an Ohio man was arrested for leaving a threatening voicemail against the life and family of Representative Steve Shivers in Ohio.
And Brent?
Iranian people attending nationwide demonstrations on International Quds Day, that is today, stressed that attempts to eliminate and destroy Israel, the region's cancerous tumor, remains the Muslim world's top priority. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei also posted on his Twitter account, quote, "There is no doubt that we will witness the demise of the Zionist entity." Demonstrators also described efforts to liberate the holy city of El Quds or Jerusalem as one of the Islamic Revolution's primary goals.
Okay, and Sam?
Otto Warmbier, the 22-year-old student who was taken prisoner in North Korea, died this week shortly after his return to the United States. He'd been imprisoned in North Korea for 17 months. After he went into a coma there, the United States demanded that he was returned to America. Obviously, he never should have been visiting North Korea in the first place, but his death does show how horrific North Korea is when it comes to human rights.
Okay, and back to Richard.
Wednesday was supposed to be a day of rage in Britain. It was the state opening of Parliament, but left-wing activists wanted to basically shut down the government, was the way they put it. It was organized mostly by a Marxist group, the Movement for Justice, by any means necessary. But they've allied with some of the top leaders of the left-wing Labour Party, and they're trying to blame the burning down of a tower that killed 80 people on the Conservative government. And they're just jumping on any tragedy that they can to try and stir up anger against that government.
And back to Andrew.
Scientists at the University of Arizona have determined that there may be another planet somewhere between the size of Earth and Mars beyond the Kuiper Belt. In January of 2016, a separate group of scientists predicted that the existence of a Neptune-sized planet orbiting the sun as far as 25 times further out than Pluto is. Both predictions were based on abnormalities in the way the planets rotate, showing that there has to be some source of gravity coming from further out in the solar system.
And once again to Brent.
The Iranian-backed terrorist army Hezbollah has set up a network of observation posts along the border with Israel under the guise of a civilian organization called Green Without Borders, according to intelligence Israel has passed on to the UN Security Council. The Hezbollah-funded group's declared goal is to raise awareness of environmental protection. However, in April, a group of civilians denied the UN interim force in Lebanon, they're there to maintain or observe the border between Israel and Lebanon, access to some of their command posts. The UN, of course, is there to monitor it, but hasn't been too successful so far. At the same time, the IDF's chief came out and said on Tuesday that Israel has evidence that Hezbollah has a presence in every third or fourth house in southern Lebanon.
And back to Sam.
Islamist militants in the Philippines are being pounded by Duterte's government. After a month of fighting, 300 Islamist militants have been killed. As the Islamic State continues to fracture in the Middle East, the group is experiencing a surge of support in Southeast Asian countries.
And for our final story, we'll go once again to Richard.
Good news for anybody over the age of about 12. Germany has crushed 35 tons of fidget spinners. These inexplicably popular toys were deemed to not conform to European safety laws, and so they were confiscated and annihilated.
Thank you for that, Richard. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our print edition and also to our Trumpet Brief newsletter. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Brent Noctegal, Sam Livingston, and Richard Palmer.
No problem.
Great to be here.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. And we'll leave you today with the words of Thomas Jefferson. Honesty is the first chapter in the book of wisdom. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.